We've been talking a lot about what's gone right in our careers and what to do once you're riding the wave, but maybe we should talk about when things go wrong, often catastrophically, and what you can do to keep going and build yourself up again.
I'm John Fowler, and this is Riding the Showbiz Wave, the podcast that takes you on a journey through the highs and lows of working in the entertainment and media industries, hopefully shedding some light along the way on how you can further your own career, whatever stage you're at. Asking the perceptive questions is my old chum, Drew Masters, who brings his own insights from the other side, having been an artist, a songwriter, producer, TV and film composer, award-winning TV and film composer, I should add. I've been in the business for over four decades and have worked with platinum-selling artists, award-winning actors, writers, and therefore I'm now in a very privileged position to talk about my experiences and hopefully impart some useful information onto those who want to join in.
So let me give you some examples of some of the things that have happened to me, and let's see, you know, what your thoughts are. I'd be interested to know what your take is. One example, you know, when I was starting out, I was desperate for cash, like everyone was, and someone was offering me a single deal on a track that I'd written. I remember what happened is that he held back on the deal. It was promised, it was coming, the money was coming, and he just held back and held back, and I was absolutely desperate for the cash, as was my band partner at the time. At the very, very last minute, he sent over a contract that was utterly dreadful. And I think this is something that happens quite a lot, is that you don't get to see the contracts until really it's too late and you're so desperate for the cash and you're so invested in this deal that you'll sign anything. And I did, and I signed it. And in that contract, it said that the advance was returnable, not recoupable. And it was only $2,000, but that $2,000 was everything I was going to be living on for the next few months. I mean, I desperately needed that money. So we signed this deal and everything was fine. We made the records, nothing much happened. And I didn't think anything of it. We all parted ways. And then about a year later, and I remember it was just before Christmas, and I remember that because it was so painful, I got a letter in the post saying, "Dear Drew, that money we gave you, we'd like it back, please, within 7 days. And I remember being utterly horrified. And I didn't know where to go. I mean, I couldn't afford legal advice. I didn't know any lawyers. I didn't know anyone. I didn't know what to do. I can tell you what I did in that situation, but I'd be interested to know what you think. I mean, should I have signed the deal in the first place?
Well, it's very easy with hindsight to say that one shouldn't have signed that deal, but it is not a unique situation. There is a feeling you get carried away and everything is great and it won't do any harm. But I would urge caution when being presented with anything to do with money. There is no such thing as a free lunch. Something will be expected. A, sell the records to take care of the money that's being offered, and therefore it is recouped. But words like not a returnable urge you to read that again. Are you sure it said returnable, not non-returnable? So it's usually a non-refundable advance, which is recoupable against. So any advance should be non-refundable, because that makes it, therefore, the risk is up the buyer, the record label. It makes it their risk. It's very, very difficult when you're young and relatively desperate for money, and to get jump on that wave, you know, you'll almost do anything. Nowadays, I'm really pleased to see there is so much information out there and online about basic understanding of a deal, a letter of agreement or a contract. And there is also, I have to say, a great deal of free advice being given by managers, lawyers and executives in not only the music business, but the publishing business, the TV industry, the film and TV industry, as far as actors are concerned. So there's a lot of free advice out there, but I'm afraid, you know, it's a cautionary tale. But yes, if you're signing something, and I have to say, in good old English law, if you haven't taken the advice of a solicitor, the actual deal, I think one could argue, is rendered null and void.
That's interesting that you say that, because I deal with all my own TV contracts for my TV composing work. And in there, it always says you agree that you have sought legal advice before signing this contract. And of course, I never have, and none of us composers ever have, because there isn't enough money being offered to us to do these jobs for us to be able to pay a lawyer. I mean, I don't know a lawyer that would take even 10% of what I'm being paid to do these TV jobs. It used to be true that if you didn't get legal advice, the contract was technically null and void. I'm not sure if that's still the case.
No, I think you may be right. My advice to anybody who is looking at paperwork, documentation of any description, to get some kind of heads up on what you are expected to sign. And if you can avoid signing anything until you have that advice, I would suggest that. But I do feel, I have great sympathy for kids, you know, who want to, you know, get some money in the bank, pay to shoot a video or some socials. Yeah, I mean, again, record labels probably don't offer singles deal these days. They'll wait five or six singles deep.
That was a long time ago. And interesting what you're saying. I mean, I think you're right. My experience now with media lawyers is that most of them, if you find someone, you know, either very senior or very junior, will gladly help you out at the start of your career, have a look over a contract, not charge you, they'll probably just tell you walk away or take the deal, but know that it's not great. The Musicians Union also do contractual advice if you're a member of that. I'm guessing maybe Equity and other unions that cover other professions in
very much
also do that.
Very much so. And that's a great point you make. Musicians Union and all the big institutions will have great advice about that side of the industry.
They also have fairly low joining fees for people starting out. So if you're not earning a lot of money, you don't pay very much to join. So it's definitely worth seeking out some of these organizations and seeing what they offer.
And I would urge, people starting out in all of the creative industries, you know, do your research about the trade associations, the Equities, the Spotlights, PRS, and engage. Because as I said many times, being part of a community, you'll find out a lot more than sitting at home thinking you've just created the next Dark Side of the Moon. Try to engage in trade associations.
I think they are
valuable.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And let me tell you what happened in the end of that story. So actually what happened was I sent a letter back saying, I delivered everything that you asked. You didn't manage to do anything with the record. And I simply don't have the money to return. So that's it. You'll move, basically. And guess what? They came back and said, oh, of course you can keep the money. As you say, never sign anything that's returnable.
Shelling out money on things, obviously, if you are going to bespoke studio for a reason, that's a different thing. But, you know, there are operators that will promise you the world, especially in the world of modelling. I have dipped my toe into that world. There are lots of individuals who will want to take significant sums of money to create the most amazing portfolio. You should be very, very careful. Look, if people promise you they're going to create the most incredible EP or selection of tracks in this studio, be careful what happens in terms of ownership of those tapes.
Yeah, well, I can tell you that whoever records the music owns the master recordings, and that is currently the most valuable part of a song. So right now, in 2025, whoever owns the master recordings is the one who's going to make some money from that track.
And again, I even to this day, photography, image rights is an area of the business that we should probably chat more about. Some years ago in the world of professional soccer, the tax payable on image rights revenue was less than your wages. And so footballers used to quite frequently apportion quite a lot of their wages as image rights. And I always found that very, very crafty, but quite interesting. But again, the corporate, who owns a photograph of you? Who owns a photograph of me? You might think you do. Well, you absolutely do not. And it is the person who's taken the photograph. And very rarely will they sell it to you for use across all usage in perpetuity. What the more successful artists do is they will buy out any image rights and then license them back to magazines, to marketing materials, whatever they need. And, you know, don't get caught out using other people's copyrights.
I'm going to run another story by you of something that happened to me in my days as a recording artist. And I'd be quite interested to see what your perspective is on this, because, again, at the time, I felt quite hard done by. And I think it's quite interesting to look at the artist's perspective versus the label's perspective. Going back to your days at international marketing at Sony, and it was around about the same sort of time, in fact, I'd be interested to know your perspective on this. You know, who was right here? So I was at a major label. We had an album of pop songs, and the head of A&R wanted to do some dance remixes. His thinking being that we'd get a bit of traction in the clubs, and I think more, you know, his mates would get paid quite handsomely. And we're talking about 10K for a mix, which going back, you know, to the mid 90s, that was a lot of money for a dance remix. And we weren't desperately happy about this. You know, we're artists. We've been signed as artists. We've got a style. Someone else taking our music, and this was early days in dance remixing, someone taking our music, making it into something else, and then that possibly being the thing that actually launches our career, didn't sit very comfortably. But more importantly, what we want to know is who's paying for this? The label were paying for it. But was it recoupable from our sales? And I tried to ask this question. I couldn't get a straight answer from anyone. And in the end, I left a message with our A&R man's PA and said, you know, look, can you get him to call us and just tell us who is paying for this ultimately? Oh my God. Did that unleash almighty hell? He called me up and he was spitting blood. He was like, don't ever ask who's paying for something. Do not ever challenge any decision that I make about your careers. In fact, just don't. And I remember being absolutely shocked. You know, this is money we're expected to pay back out of our wages for something we didn't even want. Anyway, be interested to know what your perspective is on that from the other side.
Well, most of that which you describe is true. It would have been his mates trousering a decent fee. In terms of recording costs, I would have thought the entirety, 100% of those recording costs are recoupable before you get anything. So that would be understood. It's interesting. Additional recording, not necessary that artistically, that's a negotiation. Again, if you start saying no, all of a sudden you're a difficult artist. And we know what happens to difficult artists. If they haven't sold 1 million records or 500,000, difficult artists, they retain that moniker for a long time.
I mean, we were really already stuffed at that point because we'd signed to the MD, who then became the president of the record label, brought back the person who had previously been head of A&R, but had gone to another label. And he had passed on us whilst he had been at that label. He didn't like what we did. He didn't like us. And he said as much when he came back. And at that point, we might as well have given up and gone down the pub. But we persevered. We soldiered on for 2 years and didn't have any hits. But there are so many reasons why that happened. And a lot of them, I would say 90% of it was us. And, you know, mistakes we made, simply the music not connecting. I think we were a bit old. We were in our late 20s, which sounds terribly young to me now. But, you know, we were competing against. I remember going and switching on the Christmas lights in Torquay, one of the highlights of my life. And there was a band there, 17, 18-year-olds. And we just felt like their dads. It's that 10-year age difference made us such a difference.
Firstly, there's nothing wrong with turning on Christmas lights in our province.
I loved it. No,
I have
great.
Play, nothing wrong with that.
I also like Torquay. It was a lovely place.
In terms of, you know, the way labels deal with bands, my personal view on this at the moment, the bigger artists are simply getting bigger. I believe there is a very healthy appetite to develop new artists, but the developing of new artists doesn't happen at record labels anymore. What I loved was that the A&R function was just to create the most amazing piece of work. I don't think some young A&R people knew who ended up paying for what. That was the accountant's job. And I'm afraid if it was a recording cost, that was all coming back to them. Things like video, promotional videos, the fantastic, the age of the, you know, video clip, some of that was recharged to the artist. But again, normally it was about half.
In my experience, and going back again to sort of mid-90s, it was very much a way that they locked you into your long-term deal so that you never recouped. You'd do your first album. If it was successful and it was big, then you would go in, you'd start to spend a lot of money on your second album. You would release your first single with a shockingly expensive video, which would come out of your unrecouped balance and cross-collateralize, I think was the word they used to use back then before 360. And they would take it out of the money that you were starting to recoup from album one. So they would keep you basically indebted. Otherwise, you would walk.
And you know, lest we forget that it was a very different industry in terms of where the money was coming from. And labels were earning a great deal of money out of selling these bits of plastic, as we've touched on before. Nowadays, labels are getting still an incredible amount of money of streaming globally, incredible volumes of the track, because there are no boxes, there's no labels, there's nothing that need to do. Certainly, distribution doesn't exist in the way that it used to. Record labels are doing fine, thank you very much.
I think it's interesting. We were talking before we started recording about some the artists that we know and some artists that we're interested in, and they're all quite small niche artists who are all coincidentally on fairly small labels, either little boutique labels or just with one person or managed by one person. And you look at it and you think, well, what's in it for everyone? You look at the figures on YouTube. They're not huge, but they're selling tickets to concerts. They're selling merch. They're selling physical copies of the albums when they make them. So there's a little bit of money there, but it's obviously, you know, a lot of love for the music, which is what they should be. And I think that's great. But actually, it's interesting because when I think about it, what they've all got in common is that actually what they're getting from their label is mentorship, because they're not getting huge budgets. They're not getting huge international marketing clout, but what they're getting is basically artist development.
It was certainly true that the record labels did a lot of management, ended up managing the artists a lot of the time. The artist manager, especially for a new band, the manager is usually a mate. Very rarely was it an established manager, because nothing was established. I can remember doing a lot of management with bands in terms of career management. Where is this going to go? I get that was probably the joy of having a breakout artist that had a hit. There's nothing better than unknown having a hit record.
Yeah, I think that's similar to what I was looking for when I took on an agent as a TV composer. I was really looking for someone to help me make decisions about which jobs to take. I was being offered a lot of stuff. I was doing, you know, 7 jobs at once, really exhausted, really struggling to keep up with everything, and wanting someone to say, look, do you know what? Don't do that job. Do this one, because this is the one that's going to lead you here. And what's really interesting is, of course, that doesn't happen for obvious reasons, because most agents are going to go, just take it all and get someone to help you if you want, or delegate it to someone, but don't say no. And I didn't really get what I was looking for. I was really hoping for mentorship and a bit of handholding, as you say, just someone to share the journey with. It's incredibly lonely as an artist.
Well, it's so interesting you say that. It's a lonely old place. And if you're a solo artist, or even a composer, that can be quite a solitary existence if you don't have the budget to, you know, hire mates and get people in. And that's why I do encourage people all the time, get out and about and share ideas, and don't be paranoid about sharing any kind of info. And it is this school playground that I talk about. You've got to be mates with as many people as you possibly can.
I think we call it gatekeeping now, don't we?
Well, yeah.
Don't be a gatekeeper.
Yeah.
Just share. I mean, I'm always happy to share, because I love talking about this stuff, and it gives me enormous amounts of pleasure being able to help people coming through.
I think there's an overall sort of general point about the differences between agents and managers. And it's certainly true in the music business that historically the managers would be really proper and rounded artist managers, and hopefully, I think, offering everything that you would expect from a manager. An agent in the music business was normally defined by the booking agent, as in booking the gigs and finding the promoter and sorting the live side out. In other areas of the business, such as a literary agent or an actor's agent, they very much work as a volume business. You know, you don't have a literary manager, you have a literary agent, and they will normally be responsible for volume work. So there is a more binary existence. The proposer will come in, they will talk to the author or the actor, yes or no. I don't believe there is as much pastoral care if you're an agent as there is when you're a manager, because as a manager, you have fewer clients. This was always my personal view. You have fewer clients that enables you to spend more time with your client managing them. The question I get asked a lot is, do I need a manager? Do I need an agent? When do I get a manager? How do I get a manager? We've touched on this, and we'll touch on it again, I'm sure. You have to have an awareness, and this is also refers back to my advice about knowing the business that you're in. If you're a young actor, know the process. If you're a young musician, know that, and you want to get signed and you want to play live, know the process.
And I know we've talked about this before, but just remind me how you work out what that process is.
Well, actually, it's doing a bit of homework, watching TV or going to the theatre or seeing a movie or watching Glastonbury. and being inspired, and you will be writing songs and playing in your band, and that has an organic and rather wonderful process. But if you really think you want to make a career out of it, you know, be aware that it is going to be really hard work. There are far fewer jobs than there are applicants. In the entertainment industry, is absolutely overcrowded with unemployed people. But know the process as best you can. There's plenty of resource. But as I said repeatedly, there's nothing better than having a group of like-minded people who may be at your drama club, your drama society, or in a band, or there's a battle of the bands, or there's an open mic. It's so, so important, because your peers are much more honest about things than some.
I always find I know when I'm in the room. So what I mean by that is, if I write a piece of music for a TV show, I'm sitting in my studio and it sounds great and I love it. I think it's brilliant. When I take it into the edit and I sit in the edit with the director and the editor, and they lay it back to the picture and we play it in the room, for some reason, you can hear every single thing that's wrong with it. And it's not because the speaker's different. It's because suddenly there's other people in the room. And it's really odd. I've discussed this with other creative people. I think it works across lots of different creative arts. There's something about being with other people and sharing the listening experience where you suddenly, there's this clarity of, oh my God, that bit was terrible.
But composing for film and TV, and this is what's so wonderful about the various parts of this business called show, is that your process and ultimately success is based on almost precision engineering.
I think there's some truth in that. I think that certainly every note that you write as a composer for screen matters. Alexandre Desplat, his score for Coco before Chanel, which I absolutely love. It's quite an old score now, but there's a scene in it where she is in this old house and she's looking around and she's opening drawers, she's looking at pictures on the walls, and basically the notes just follow her, so that he's hardly playing any notes, but when a note happens, it's on her look, it's on her thoughts, it's in her head, it's what is she seeing, what is she feeling about what she's seeing. And it's absolutely fascinating. I remember watching it and thinking it was one of the first times I'd seen someone do that so masterfully, but without being what we call Mickey Mousing, where you literally just sort of play something that mimics the sound of what you're seeing, it, like a Mickey Mouse cartoon. And if you don't know what that means, next time you watch a cartoon, you'll understand what I mean. And it was beautiful, and it made me really think about how much every note matters. You know, the minute you put one note wrong in a film score or a TV score, it leads the audience to feel something else. And if that feeling isn't the feeling that you're supposed to be feeling, it's wrong. And so what you're saying is absolutely correct. It has to be forensic. You really have to understand, what the next note is going to tell the audience.
And that's a very different process from other areas.
Totally different to a pop song.
The music business, absolutely.
Where it's a lot of other things, energy, vibe.
Let me ask you something. Are there a whole raft of 14-year-old kids at schools up and down the country who are burgeoning film and TV composers? Because there will be kids up and down the country thinking, how the hell do they, I mean, who'd even wrote that? I'm sure there must be a...
I think that there is, and I think that it's fairly new. I mean, when I got into the business, which was, I guess, around the late 90s, but I'd been sort of doing it on and off, but certainly around the late 90s, it was still an area where you didn't wake up in the morning and go, I want to be a telly composer. It wasn't really a job that you aimed for. It was generally filled with people who were either, you know, resting jazz musicians or classical musicians or people who had failed to make it somewhere else. There weren't many people doing it because they utterly loved it. But I think that's completely changed. The ambition of television music changed during the 2000s, and the scale of it to lift it to a point where it was exciting and it had value. And I think
that makes so much sense. Even you can sense that if you are sad enough to look at the TV of the 80s and 90s and how pretty analog and a bit naff it was.
Although if you go back into the 70s, you get some fantastic scores from people who were basically either out of work jazz musicians or just between gigs. And there were some incredible scores. So you think to like the Sweeney, Professionals, all of those sorts of things. Very kind of like 70s jazz rock scores.
Yeah.
They were really, really
incredible, incredibly powerful songs as well. And there was a famous Roald Dahl, Tales of the Unexpected.
Oh, yeah.
Tales of the Unexpected was a very memorable, memorable music. I firmly believe that the industry hasn't changed that much, but now those recognizable, really hooky sounds appear on your Instagram posts and they appear on your TikToks. And, you know, we know for a fact that many a hit has come simply from repetition on TikTok and recognition.
Yeah, well, of course, around about, I guess, the late 90s, they started to remove the title sequences from a lot of TV shows. And it's come back a bit now, but there was a... So if you look at something like The Apprentice that I do, there is no title sequence. There's a pre-title, and the pre-title is an introduction, a build-up. And then there's a, what we call a title card, where it says The Apprentice.
And that's it.
And that's it. But the title card is literally, if you go and look at it next time, you know, it's on, it literally goes... That's the title. There is no title tune. So people think that the Prokofiev Dance of the Nights is the title music. It's not. It's pre-title.
I'm encouraged to hear you say that, you know, young musicians can develop a real love for composing. And
I think that people look at it now as very much a viable career, very much a viable thing that they want to do. Unfortunately, just at a time when it's going to get eroded by AI and also shrinking budgets in TV. That said, I still think there are masses of opportunities because of all the streamers, Netflix, Apple, Amazon, etc. They're making fantastic programs. And going back to what you're saying about title music, I think things like White Lotus, Slow Horses.
House of Cards was incredible.
Yeah, and actually Westworld was great. And of course, Succession. Everyone loves that, based on the Beethoven piano sonata. There's tons. It's come back a bit. It's become more fashionable again. And I think it's...
Well, that fills me with such pleasure to hear that, because I firmly believe, and there's a lot of doom and an awful lot of gloom that's spread around this industry. I've never suffered from that.
I think that there's a lot of doom and gloom around at the moment because we're coming towards the end of a cycle. There's a lot of people, they were in their 20s 20 years ago. And, you know, 20 years ago, telly was a fun place to be. It was all... You had a young crowd of people who were really excited about making new TV, you know, Pop Idol, X Factor, Big Brother, The Apprentice. They've all grown up through TV and they've now got to the other end of their careers and they're all very senior. And I think a lot of them are quite bored. The budgets aren't quite what they used to be. The fun's slightly gone out of it. I think a new generation will just take over and run with it and they'll take on their own things. I know when I got into telly, I got in quite late. I was, you know, already, I think I was in my late 30s. And I'd done some TV before, but that's when I sort of got into it as a proper career. And a lot of people my age were getting out. They were saying, you know, oh, it's not like it used to be. There was used to be so much more money, so much more freedom. It was so much more fun. And it's just like, there's no budgets anymore. And, you know, nobody likes what I'm doing. And, you know, they don't like it when I get the BBC orchestra in. And, you know, they all want sort of electronic scores. And I was like, great. It sounds fantastic. Where do I sign? And I was willing to go into the industry at that point for less money than my peers had, you know, 10 years previously in what they thought was the golden age. Because it was fine. It was fine. And I've done very well from it. And I think that that's what will happen with the next generation. They'll come along and they'll go, well, it's a bunch of old men. And we are, a lot of us, a bunch of old men who, you know, coming up to retirement, we'll come in, we'll do it differently. We'll just look at it as, you know, how do we make a living from writing music?
I think that that's so, so true in a fairly significant way of the world of content creators, influencers, and the way, I suppose, what used to be endorsement, brand ambassadors in terms of brands and how they engage. I've done some work in that area and that has led to the whole talent management landscape changing. Lots of agencies, lots of management companies set up specifically and solely to represent influencers, content creators. It's an incredibly lucrative part of the market. I have to say that the qualification, both from talent and management, is to be incredibly aware of data, the way data works. It's a data-driven business. We've touched on this before about music and Spotify and social media, but certainly in terms of that huge, huge industry of content creators and slash influencers, you've got to know your data. You've got to know how it's analyzed and what to provide. And I, as a manager, have received very, very short talent proposals, and the questions they have are all data related questions, not what my client is doing, you know, for the, is she going to be on telly for the next 6 months, what is her profile going to do. It's all data driven. And if young people out there think that they can do without social media, I think that's very unwise to not engage with it. And certainly,
so we were talking earlier about these bands that we were interested in, learning a bit more about what they've been doing recently, and we went online and found that one of them didn't actually have any YouTube videos, and we were quite shocked. I mean, it's like, well, how are we supposed to know what you look like and what you sound like? And obviously we then clicked on an Apple Music link, but I mean, it's got no visuals to go with that.
Yeah.
Let us know if you've got any questions. Let us know what you're interested in. Get in touch via the socials. We're out there. We'll be on TikTok. We'll be on Insta. We'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to Riding the Showbiz Wave with me, John Fowler.
And me, Drew Masters.
Tune in next time for more reminiscing, more celebrity stories, and more tips on how to help your own career.